Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. In the last show, I started to review some of the main points on how to, like in The Wizard of Oz, be home at last. In other words, in the happy ending to our modern monetary fairy tale, Congress would take back the power to create money in all its forms, including the money created with accounting entries by private banks. Some of the highlights of this satisfying ending would include 1. Elimination of personal income taxes, allowing workers to keep their wages, putting spending money in people's pockets, stimulating economic growth. 2 would be elimination of mounting federal debt that must otherwise burden and bind future generations. 3 is the availability of funds for a whole range of government services that have always been needed but could not be afforded under the fractional reserve system, including improved education, environmental cleanup and preservation, universal health care, restoration of infrastructure, independent medical research, and development of alternative energy sources. The 4th point is a social security system that is sufficiently funded to support retirees, replacing private pensions that keep workers chained to unfulfilling jobs and keep employers unable to compete in international markets. 5 would be the elimination of the depressions of the business cycle that have resulted when interest rates and reserve requirements have been manipulated by the Fed to rein in out-of-control debt bubbles. Number six, the availability of loans at interest rates that are not subject to unpredictable manipulation by a private central bank, but remain modest and fixed, something borrowers can rely on in making their business decisions and in calculating their risks. And number seven, elimination of the aggressive currency devaluations and economic warfare necessary to sustain a money supply built on debt. Exchange rates would become stable, the U.S. dollar would become self-sustaining, and the United States and other countries would become self-reliant, trading freely with their neighbors without being dependent on foreign creditors or having to dominate and control other countries and markets. The truth is that this kind of happy ending is actually well within the realm of possibility, but it won't happen unless we the people get our boots on and start marching. We've become conditioned by our television sets to expect some hero politician to save the day, but the hero never appears because both sides dominating the debate are controlled by the banking industrial cartel. Nothing can or will happen until we wake up, get organized, and form a plan. So then, what sort of plan would we be talking about? The platform of a revamped populist, greenback, American nationalist, Whig Party kind of group might include 1. A bill to update the constitutional provision that Congress shall have the power to coin money, so that it reads, Congress shall have the power to create the national currency in all its forms, including not only coins and paper dollars, but the nation's credit issued as commercial loans. Number 2. A call for an independent audit of the Federal Reserve and the giant banks that own it, including an investigation of the market manipulations of the Plunge Protection Team and the CRMPG, the massive derivatives positions of a small handful of mega banks and their use to rig markets, and the use of creative accounting to mask bank insolvency. That would be a good expenditure of investigatory time. The third point is the repeal of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, construed as authorizing a federal income tax. We have to step out of the box and see the full picture, and not continue to be forced to live by the rules imposed in the box by the mega banking cartel and the fears and economic restraints that they have imposed. The fourth point would be either repeal of the Federal Reserve Act as in violation of the Constitution, or amendment of the Act to make the Federal Reserve a truly federal agency administered by the U.S. Treasury. The fifth point would be public acquisition of a network of banks to serve as local bank branches of the newly federalized banking system, either by FDIC takeover of insolvent banks, or the purchase of viable banks with newly issued U.S. currency. Besides serving depository banking functions, these national banks would be authorized to service the credit needs of the public by advancing the full faith and credit of the United States as loans. Any interest charged on advances of the national credit would be returned to the Treasury to be used in the place of taxes. The sixth point would be the elimination of money creation by private fractional reserve lending. Private lending would be limited either to recycling existing funds or to lending new funds borrowed from the newly federalized Federal Reserve. Number 7 would be authorization for the Treasury to buy back and retire all of its outstanding federal debt using newly issued U.S. notes or Federal Reserve notes. This could be done gradually over a period of years as the securities came due. In most cases, it could be done online without physical paper transfers. And I'll get back to this in a moment. For those of you just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I am speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Moving along, the eighth point, advances of interest-free credit to state and local governments for rebuilding infrastructure and other public projects. Congress might also consider authorizing interest-free credit to private parties for properly monitored purposes, no speculation or shorting. The ninth point would be authorization for Congress, acting through the Treasury, to issue new currency annually to be spent on programs that promoted the general welfare. To prevent inflation, the new currency could be spent only on programs that contributed new goods and services to the economy, keeping supply in balance with demand. And issues of new currency would be capped by some ceiling, the unused productive capacity of the national workforce, or the difference between the gross domestic product and nation's purchasing power, wages, and spending income. Computer models might be run first to determine how rapidly the new money could safely be infused into the economy. Point 10 is authorization for Congress to fund programs that would return money to the Treasury in place of taxes, including the development of cheap, effective energy alternatives, wind, solar, ocean wave, etc., that could be used to the public for a fee, affordable public housing that returned rents to the government, and fee-generating public transportation. Point 11 is regulation and control of the exploding derivatives crisis, either by imposing a modest 0.25% tax on all derivative trades in order to track and regulate them, or by imposing an outright ban on derivatives trading. If the handful of banks responsible for 97% of all derivative trades were found after audit to be insolvent, they could be put into receivership and their derivative trades could be unwound by the FDIC as receiver. Initiation of a new round of international agreements modeled on the Bretton Woods Accords, addressing the following monetary issues, among others. A is a pegging of national currency exchange rates to the value either of an agreed-upon standardized price index or an agreed-upon basket of commodities. B, international regulation of or elimination of speculation in derivatives, short sales, and other forms of trading that are used to manipulate markets. C, grants or interest-free loans of a global currency issued greenback style on the model of the special drawing rights of the IMF, but overseen by an international Congress that is truly democratic rather than corporate or banker-controlled. And D, the elimination of burdensome and unfair international debts. This could be done by simply writing the debts off the books of the issuing banks, reversing the sleight of hand by which the loan money was created in the first place. And the 13th point on the platform is other domestic reforms that might be addressed include publicly financed elections, verifiable paper trails of all voting machines, media reform to break up monopoly ownership, lobby reform, sustainable energy development, basic universal health coverage, reinstating farm parity pricing, and reinstating and strengthening the security laws. Like the earlier greenback and populist parties, this grassroots political party might not win any major elections, but it could raise awareness, and when the deluge hit, it could provide an arc, because there is no way that a deluge is going to be averted with the way the national and global economy functions. We need to spark a revolution in the popular understanding of money and banking while free speech is still available on the internet, in independent media, and in books. New ideas and alternatives need to be communicated and put into action before the door to our debtor's prison slams shut. The place to begin is in the neighborhood, with brainstorming sessions in living rooms in the populist tradition. Populists were the people, and what they sought was a people's currency. Reviving the American system of government-issued money would not represent a radical departure from the American tradition. It would represent a radical return. Like Dorothy, we the people would finally have come home. Now, we will review all those points again in the next show, but we'll continue today with the collapse of a 300-year Ponzi scheme. I'll start with a quote from The Matrix, Cypher to Neo. "Buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy, cause Kansas is going bye-bye." That's a quote from the movie, and I apologize to all Kansas fans after March Madness just ended. But back to the Wizard of Oz in the chapter of The Cyclone. Quote, "It was very dark, and the wind howled horribly around her. At first, she wondered if she would be dashed to pieces when the house fell again. But as the hours passed and nothing terrible happened, she stopped worrying and resolved to wait calmly and see what the future would bring." Close quote. The wheels started flying off the banker's money machine in July 2007, just after the book, The Web of Debt, was first published. The Fed and the Plunge Protection Team did their best to keep the curtain drawn while they frantically patched together bailout schemes. But the choking and sputtering of the broken machine was too much to conceal. Sudden dramatic declines in the stock market, the housing market, and the credit market were all quite frightening to the residents of Oz huddled in their vulnerable thatched roofed houses. But there wasn't much they could do about it, so like Dorothy, they resolved to wait and see what the future would bring. They had long known that things were not as they seemed in the Emerald City, and the old facade had to come down before the real Emerald Isle could appear. The bubble burst and the meltdown began in earnest when investment bank Bear Stearns had to close two of its hedge funds in June of 2007. The hedge funds were trading in collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, loans that had been sliced up, bundled with less risky loans, and sold as securities to investors. To induce rating agencies to give them AAA ratings, these financial products had then been insured against loss with derivative bets. The alarm bells went off when the creditors tried to get their money back. The CDOs were put up for sale, and there were no takers at anywhere near the stated valuations. Mark Gilbert, writing on Bloomberg.com, observed, quote, "The efforts by Bear Stearns creditors to extricate themselves from their investments have laid bare one of the derivative market's dirty little secrets. The prices are mostly generated by a confidence trick. As long as all of the participants keep a straight face when agreeing on a particular value for a security, that's the price. As soon as someone starts giggling, however, the jig is up, and the bookkeepers might have to confess to a new, lower price." Close quote. And I'll come back to this in a moment. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Well, the secret of the Wall Street wizards was out. The derivatives game was a confidence trick, and when confidence was lost, the trick was no longer working. The $681 trillion derivatives bubble was an illusion. Panic spread around the world as increasing number of investment banks had to prevent runs on their hedge funds by refusing withdrawals from nervous customers who had bet the farm on this illusory scheme. Between July and August of 2007, the Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 1,000 points, prompting commentators to warn of a 1929-style crash. When the liquidity crisis became too big for the investment banks to handle, the central banks, of course, stepped in, But in this case, the crisis wasn't actually the result of lack of money in the system. The newly created money lent to subprime borrowers was still circulating in the economy. The borrowers just weren't paying it back to the banks. Investors still had money to invest. They just weren't using it to buy AAA asset-backed securities that actually had toxic subprime mortgages embedded in them. The faith-based money system of the banks was frozen into illiquidity because no one was buying it anymore. The solution of the Federal Reserve in the United States, along with the central banks of Europe, Canada, Australia, and Japan, was Wizard of Oz again, to conjure up $315 billion in credit and extend it to troubled banks and investment firms. The rescued institutions included Countrywide Financial, the largest U.S. mortgage lender. Countrywide was being called the next Enron, not only because it was facing bankruptcy, but because it was guilty of some quite shady practices. It underwrote and sold hundreds of thousands of mortgages containing false and misleading information, which were then sold to the international banking and investment markets as securities. The lack of liquidity in the markets was blamed directly on the corrupt practices at Countrywide and other lenders of its ilk. According to one analyst, entire nations are now at risk of their economies collapsing because of this fraud. But that did not deter the U.S. Central Bank from sending in a lifeboat. Countrywide was saved from insolvency when Bank of America bought $2 billion of Countrywide stock with a loan made available by the Fed at newly reduced interest rates. Bank of America also got a windfall out of the deal, since when investors learned that Countrywide was being rescued, the stock it had just purchased with money borrowed from the Fed shot up. The market hemorrhage was bandaged over, Dow turned around, and investors breathed a sigh of relief. All was well again in Stepfordsville, or so it seemed. Just as the men behind the curtain appear to have everything under control in the United States, the global crisis hit in England. In September of 2007, Northern Rock, Britain's fifth largest mortgage lender, was besieged at branches across the country as thousands of worried customers queued for hours in hopes of getting their money out before the doors closed. It was called the worst bank run since the 1970s. Bank officials feared that as much as half the bank's deposit base could be withdrawn before the run was over. By September 14, 2007, Northern Rock's share price had dropped 30%, and on September 17th, it dropped another 35%. There was talk of a public takeover. If the run on deposits looked out of control, said one official, Northern Rock would effectively be nationalized and put into administration so it could be wound down. The bloodletting slowed after the government issued an emergency pledge to Northern Rock's worried savers that their money was safe, but analysts said the credit crisis was here to stay. As BBC News explained the problem, quote, Northern Rock has struggled since money markets seized up over the summer. The bank is not short of assets, but they are tied up in loans to homeowners. Because of the global credit crunch, it has found it difficult to borrow the cash to run its day-to-day operations. Close quote. The bank was borrowing short to lend long, playing a shell game with its customers' money. While angry depositors were storming Northern Rock in England, Countrywide Financial was again quietly being snatched from the void in the United States, this time with $12 billion in newfound financing. Financing found where? Peter Ralter wrote in LeMetropoleCafe.com on September 16, 2007, quote, why is it that $2 billion investment by Bank of America and Countrywide was front page news in August, while the company's new $12 billion financing is buried on the business pages? Isn't it funny, too, that Countrywide did specify who's providing all that money, saying only that it comes from new or existing credit lines? There was no comment, either, on the credit or interest terms. This for $2 billion. It makes me suspect that Countrywide's new angel isn't the B of A, but rather the B of B, the Bank of Bernanke, close quote. But Countrywide's downward slide continued until January of 2008, when Bank of America agreed to buy it for $4.1 billion. Again, eyebrows were raised. Bank of America had just announced that it was cleaning house and cutting 650 jobs. Was the deal another bailout with money funneled from the Fed and its plunge protection team? As John Hoffel noted in 2002, major financial crises are never announced in the newspapers, but are instead treated as a form of national security secret, so that various bailouts and market manipulation activities can be performed behind the scenes. That is true in the United States, where bailouts are conducted by a private central bank answerable to other private banks. But in England, the central bank is at least technically owned by the government, warranting more transparency. The cost of that transparency, however, was that the Bank of England came under heavy public criticism for the bailout of Northern Rock. It was criticized for waiting too long and for bailing the bank out at all, emboldening other banks in their risky ventures. At one time, U.S. bailouts were also done openly through the FDIC under the auspices of Congress, but that approach cost votes. The failure of President George Bush Sr. to win a second term in office was blamed in part on the bailout of long-term capital management engineered during his first term. The public cost was all too obvious taxpayers and the more solvent banks, which wound up paying higher FDIC insurance premiums to provide a safety net for their high-rolling competitors. As Congressman Ron Paul noted in 2005, quote, "These premiums, which are actually taxes, are the primary source of funds for the deposit insurance fund. This fund is used to bail out banks that experience difficulties meeting commitments to their depositors. Thus, the deposit insurance system transfers liability for poor management decisions from those who made the decisions to their competitors. This system punishes those financial institutions that follow sound practices as they are forced to absorb the losses of their competitors. This also compounds the moral hazard problem created whenever government socializes business losses. In the event of a severe banking crisis, Congress likely will transfer funds from general revenues into the deposit insurance fund, which would make all taxpayers liable for the mistakes of a few." End quote. Under the Fed's new stealth bailout plan, it could avoid this sort of unpleasant scrutiny by taxing the public indirectly through inflation. No longer was it necessary to go begging to Congress for money. The Fed could just create credit with accounting entries. As Chris Powell commented on the GATA website in August 2007, quote, "In central banking, if you need more money for anything, you just sit down and type some up and click it over to somebody who is ready to do as you ask with it." Close quote. And I will continue next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.